Hey folks, I'm Simon Ward, your host for this weekly podcast. Over the years, I've come to realise that achieving one's goals as a triathlete is not possible unless you support this with good nutrition, excellent recovery, develop a robust framework through mobility and strength training, and have a happy, balanced work and family life. Each of these elements contributes to our race day performances and gives us the best chance of turning those dreams into reality. Each week, my goal is to introduce you to the experts and thought leaders in each of these fields to help you squeeze the most from your life and enjoy racing success. So, without further ado, let's crack on with this week's guest. Today on the show, I have Alex Hutchinson. Alex came to my attention when I was in Boulder last November, and he did a fantastic presentation on the contents of his book. Really, I'll read it out because it's a long title. It's called Endure, Mind, Body, and the Curiously Elastic Limits of Human Performance. And I think the Curiously Elastic Limits of Human Performance was the title of your presentation, Alex, and that really got my attention, as I'm sure it does a lot of people. So welcome to the show, firstly.
Thanks, Simon. I appreciate the invitation. It's great to reconnect after the conference.
Hey, you're most welcome. It seems like too long, actually, until I got in touch with you, so I do apologize for that. Now, you've also written some good articles for Outside Magazine. I read one that you'd written recently about you were testing some artificial intelligence software, I think, for athletes.
Well, I was writing about, yeah, there was a study that was trying to figure out what using the vast powers of modern computers to see if they could figure out the age-old question of running form, which, of course, they couldn't.
Yeah, and that's Training Peaks have been talking about how they can use artificial intelligence. And another friend of mine was telling me about somebody who's been harnessing all the data on Strava to try and predict somebody's, you know, what training somebody should be doing. But I'm still not convinced. If they can't work out what somebody's stress levels are and sleep quality, I'm not sure how they can predict whether they're in the right state to train hard or not.
Yeah, I mean, well, ultimately, my question for these sorts of things is the sort of training equivalent of the Turing test is show me that you can do better than a coach who checks in with an athlete now and then and asks them honest questions. And if you can do better than that, that's great. But boy, I won't be holding my breath for all the science and technology in the world to beat just a good, you know, honest coach-athlete relationship.
Well, you predicted at ECS, you were talking about the two-hour marathon and you revised your prediction for 2030. Do you think we're going to get good artificial intelligence training software before somebody runs sub 2 hours?
I should probably retire from the forecasting business. My record isn't good because I initially forecast 2075 for the two-hour marathon, and that's looking a little bit overly cautious. So maybe I'm just a skeptic and a cynic. So who knows what will come? But it could be a good race between our artificial intelligence overlord coaches and the 2 hour marathon idea, or maybe the one will get us to the other. Who knows?
maybe yeah. Although coaches have done pretty well helping athletes to win gold medals and set world records so far, haven't they? And using good old pen and paper and a stopwatch.
Yeah, there's a lot of the science that, you know, I mean, my job, as we'll probably get into, is writing about new science in the endurance realm, and a lot of it is validating stuff that coaches were doing 50 years ago. And that doesn't mean it's worthless. It's really interesting because coaches were also doing lots of stupid things 50 years. They're not stupid. Maybe that's a little harsh, but coaches had some good ideas, and coaches also have some bad ideas. And it's always nice to verify and test and try and understand why some things work and why other things don't. And maybe that leads us to refine our training techniques. But boy, it's a rare scientific development where you can't say, "Oh yeah, that's what the Finns were doing in the 1930s." It's often
yeah. Before we get onto our warm up quiz, Alex, let's talk about how you got to where you are now. Then you were a runner, I believe, in your college days. You still are. Sorry, I apologize. Yeah, no,
that's fine. I come from the running world. I ran throughout high school and university, and ran pretty seriously through my 20s and early 30s. I competed for the Canadian national team, which is you know, not to knock it down. It's a humble national team. But I was, let's say a good national class runner initially on the track as a middle distance runner, sort of 1500 meter runner, but I also did some cross country and event at towards the end of my career to at some mountain running at the, on the world level.
Hmm. So just for listeners to get a feel for the level you were running at then, what were some of your significant times and performances?
Oh yes, I was subtly hunting for you to ask me that. My 1500 meter best was 3 minutes 42.43 seconds, and if you look that up on the official IAAF tables, it works out to about a 400.01 mile. Ah. So not that I'm bitter or anything, but that's so I was about a 4 minute miler, by which I don't mean a sub 4 minute miler, unfortunately. But and I had similar times at maybe a little bit weaker at longer distance. I ran 8 flat for 3,000 meters, 13:52 for 5,000 meters, 49:20 for 10 miles.
Mm. Yeah, I think there'll be a few people listening to this that'll be thinking, "Well, that's not too shabby. I'd give my right arm for something close to that."
Well, if they're triathletes, they can take comfort from knowing that I'm just always one stroke away from drowning when I'm in the pool.
I had a friend who was certainly a GB record holder at race walking, supremely fit aerobically, but put him in the pool and he did need rescuing before he got to the end.
Yeah, that's pretty familiar to me.
Yeah. So, and I understand your educational background is as a physicist, which is always very interesting when I speak to people who are journalists. So what was the sort of journey from physicist to journalism?
Yeah, it was not a linear progression and not a, you know, it was not plotted out in advance. I studied physics. I ended up actually in Britain for 3 years, did my PhD in physics in Britain, and then did some postdoctoral work in the States. So it was when I was 28 that I sort of finally accepted that it just wasn't quite the right fit for me, that I didn't really have the passion for it. So I went back and did a degree in journalism at that point. Spent about a year and a half after that working for a daily newspaper, sort of cutting my teeth and, you know, covering the car accidents and the what have you. And then that was 2006. I finished up there and went freelance in 2006. And since then, I've been a freelance journalist. I started out just doing anything that would pay the rent. I did a lot of writing for Canada's accounting monthly magazine and stuff, learning, so going to accounting conferences and stuff, whoever I could get a contract with. But I gradually sort of started to focus on the areas that I had interest and experience in, which were basically endurance sports and science. And eventually they kind of bumped into each other and merged and became the science of endurance sports.
And you've written a few books. Does your sort of physics background and the research you did there help help you organizing your mind and your thoughts when you're doing the research for each book?
Yeah, I mean, in a strict, direct sense, almost none of the physics I learned has any bearing on what I do today. It's, you know, it's not like when I'm writing about biomechanics, I'm like, yes, I understand how Newton's law influences the impact forces. I mean, maybe a little bit, but the vast majority of it, it's more of an indirect thing that I understand the scientific process to some extent. I'm comfortable talking about science and talking with scientists and acknowledging ignorance and I'm just comfortable in that world, even though I'm not trained in physiology or biomechanics or anything like that. And to some extent, I mean, the truth is it's sort of a chicken and egg thing. Did my scientific training give me a certain way of approaching problems, or is it my mind works in a certain way and that made me comfortable in physics, but also comfortable as a science journalist?
Okay. Well, that's given us a good introduction to how you've got to where you are now, Alex. So before we talk about your first book, I just, like all coaches, I like to have a warm up before we get started on the main part. So I sent you some questions in advance. Hopefully you've been able to have a little bit of think about them. So these are just a little bit of fun. So which cartoon character most resembles you, or do you most resemble?
Well, I'm going to skip the physical resemblance, and I'm going to actually opt for Lisa Simpson. She plays the saxophone just like me. She's very earnest, just like me. Actually, to be honest, you sent me the questions, and I went online and filled out a quiz on which cartoon character is most like you, because I was curious, and it came up with Lisa Simpson. And I thought about it, and I thought, That's fair. That's fair. That's probably as good a match as there is.
Well, I like your preparation style. That's good work. I've not heard anybody who's done that before.
They just didn't admit it.
Maybe. You've obviously met a lot of interesting and inspirational people, both in your studies and in your journalism and as an athlete. Who are the people that have most inspired you throughout your life and continue to do so?
For this one, I'm going to go with my parents, actually. And that's probably for many reasons. One, because they're wonderful, but also I have a couple of young kids now. They're 3 and the older one just turned 6. And so I'm becoming much more acutely aware of, first of all, how hard my parents worked, but also the more time goes on, the more respect I have for the way they were able to bring me and my brother up and the example they set and the values they instilled. So I'm just much more aware now of hoping to be able to live up for my kids to the way my parents were able to bring me up.
Yeah, one of our previous guests said that mothers everywhere inspired him. He said it's just such a hard job bringing up children. And
let's give a shout out for dads too. Come on,
yeah,
we're suffering too. We're doing our best.
Yeah, always get overlooked. Okay, so you did well with the cartoon character. If you if you could have one superpower granted to you, what would you have?
This was a tough one, and of course it would be nice to be able to run really fast and win races, but I think I would go with, just from a practical sense, with super ultra speed reading, to be able to get through the infinite number of books that is on my life list and that I will never get through unless I can start reading books about 50 times faster than I currently do.
Do you use Audible at all, so that you can listen to books as you're moving around the different places?
I don't. I understand the rationale, and I have lots of, it's a big thing these days. Like, people have discovered how great it is, but I work from home, so I have zero commuting time. So I don't have that dead time. When I train, I'm a runner, not a cyclist, and I really value that sort of empty space in my head and the opportunity to just let my thoughts drift. And when I'm sitting in front of the computer working, I work with words. I can't have words in my head. So I just can't find the, even for podcasts, I struggle because it's such a great medium, and here we are talking on it. I'm grateful to everyone who's taking time to listen, but I struggle to find a time in my day that is open to having someone else's words inserted directly into my skull.
Do you take time to read then? Do you make time to read each day? Do you have a set time?
I certainly read every evening. That's part of my wind down routine, is I'll spend, anywhere from 10 minutes to an hour reading before turning the lights out. If I'm on the subway going downtown, I always have a book with me. Like, so any time I have, I'll use that. And if deadlines aren't too crazy, I'm also quite fond of, after lunch, just sort of winding up on the sofa with a book and reading until my eyes close. That's my idea of heaven.
Ah, so what was the last book that you've read then? What was the last book that you actually finished?
Yeah. The one I finished most recently was Bad Blood, the story of the Theranos, the blood testing company, I can't remember. It's like Scandal and Lies in Silicon Valley or something. So it's the story of this company that turned out to be a $10 billion complete fraud.
The lady who
Elizabeth Holmes.
Yes,
the woman in charge of it. It is an absolutely gripping book. Absolutely, just you read it, and I knew the rough outlines of the story from following the news coverage, but I read the book, and I was like, "Are you kidding me? This is just absolutely mind-boggling." So, the book got a lot of attention. I absolutely recommend it. It was a very interesting book.
What fascinated me about that whole story is the number of big-hitting, wealthy entrepreneurs who you would think were eminently sensible, have made their money by backing good horses, that were taken in by her.
And wouldn't hear, even when people were trying to raise the alarm, and say, oh no, we're pretty sure. I mean, Rupert Murdoch put $100 million in that on the basis of he met her at a conference and thought, liked the cut of her jib, basically.
Yeah, part of me wondered how much of it was middle-aged to old men being charmed by a good-looking young woman. I don't want that to sound sexist, but I know if I was, it would be easy to be charmed by a woman like Elizabeth Holmes.
There does seem to be a little bit, certainly from the book, you get it's striking the number of sort of aging aging venture capitalists and big hitters who are maybe who seem to sort of see her as a daughter or a daughter figure or who they wish was their daughter. And who knows, maybe that's just because all venture capitalists are aging men, not all, a vast majority of venture capitalists are aging men. So it's certainly a dynamic, and it sort of points to maybe a blind spot in the venture capital world.
Yeah. You know, you talked about the sort of the value of that company, the speed with which she went from zero to absolute hero and back again is phenomenal.
It was a round trip journey at supersonic speed. Yeah, it was pretty wild.
Okay. So I guess that Elizabeth Holmes wouldn't be one of your mentors if you were going to choose to work with somebody for a month then.
I'm sure I could learn some lessons from her, but probably not the ones that I want to learn.
Who would you choose then?
Yeah, this was a tough one. I ended up just thinking to myself, Michael Lewis, as an example of a guy, basically as someone, you know, personally as someone who writes articles and books and tries to make them interesting stories. What I find remarkable about, so I think a lot about nonfiction writers and how they do it well. And Michael Lewis is somebody who I have enormous respect for because he's able to write about complex topics, whether it's the financial crisis or, you know, statistical analysis in sports or even back to his very first book in the 80s about how investment banking works. He conveys a lot of complex information. And until you stop and think about it, you don't even realize that's happening. He's just telling a story. He's telling an amazing story, and all that information just ends up stuck in your brain after reading the story. And that's the kind of the ultimate goal is to have people feel like they're reading a story, not like they're reading a textbook. So I'd love to sort of get a chance to pick his brains.
I'm not familiar with Michael Lewis. Can you share some of the books I might be familiar with?
Yeah. So probably the ones that's had the most attention was Moneyball, which was a story, 18 years ago about the Oakland A's in baseball, where it was this idea of the clash of, I know a good hitter when I see one, and you can tell this guy's going to succeed versus forget it. Don't look at him. Don't think about him. Let's look at the stats, and then let's compare those to the stats of the last 30 years. We know that hitters who do this have these traits end up succeeding in the major leagues. And it's, you know, it's been a long process, a sort of tooth and nail fight in professional sports. But that book is, you know, in hindsight is that, I don't know, it was like a 2002 book or something like that. You could argue that it is in the modern sports world the most influential book that exists, because the vast majority of major leagues in sports around the world have employed entire divisions to follow the precepts that he laid out almost for the first time that nobody was talking about until his book came. But he actually started out as an investment banker in the 80s at Salomon Brothers, spent a year there, was just absolutely kind of blown away by what a crazy world it is. So he quit and wrote a book about it called Liar's Poker, which kind of made his name, launched his career. It's sort of a scathing indictment of the culture of Wall Street in the 80s, maybe the sort of portrait of record of Wall Street in the 80s. One of the ones that I read more recently is, I may have the Undoing Project. I may have the title wrong. It's basically the story of Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky, who are two exceptionally influential behavioral economists. When Kahneman and Tversky died early, but Kahneman got the Nobel Prize. He's the one who then went on to write Thinking Fast and Slow 5 or 6 years ago, all about the ways we kind of trick ourselves without realizing it, the sort of hidden biases we have in our mind. And so Lewis wrote a nice book about where those ideas came from and the relationship between those two researchers.
I just checked, actually, you were right about the title of The Undoing Project.
Oh, good. So, oh, good.
that Liar's Poker is interesting. And I guess that's cyclical as well, because what he wrote in the 80s probably came true at the end of the, in 2008 as well. Those same behavioral traits were what led to that crash then.
And he wrote maybe one of the definitive books on the 2008-2009 crash. I'm blanking on the title, but it then was made into a movie and stuff. So he's a man of breadth. He's written about a lot of different topics, but however he does it, it's like, for instance, with the Kahneman and Tversky, the behavioral economics, he wrote a story about those two people. You learn a lot about the behavioral economics, but it's a story, not a textbook. And that's a skill that is, it's hard. I will say from my perspective, it's harder than it looks to actually carry that off.
I'm just thinking about that film that might have been made about
the Big
book.
Short.
Was it,
I think
was it
is what
the Big
Michael
Short? Yeah, with oh, I can never remember his name now. He's a great method actor. He was in Batman. Christian Bale was the autistic money guy that spotted all the trends and started doing that Big Short, wasn't he, on the financial markets? I think cracking film.
Yeah, I think that's starring Christian Bale, Steve Carell, Ryan Gosling, and Brad Pitt.
Yeah,
so that was the movie, and it was based on, if I'm not totally crazy, it was based on the Michael Lewis book.
Yeah. The film was good. So it sounds like you've given us a good selection of books to get reading there.
Yeah. You could fill a year with Michael Lewis books, and all the ones I've read were worth the time invested for sure.
And you know, the way he writes his books, then is that what you aspire to when you write your books, to create a story? I mean, it would be easy when you're talking about some of the stuff in Endure, for instance, to get people lost in the technical stuff. But I guess if you create a story and bring it down to a level that people can understand, then they'll pick up the concepts a lot easier.
Yeah. I mean, Endure, the hugest challenge in Endure was not to make it just a big literature review. I had hundreds of studies that I wanted to write about. And the question is, how do I get people to swallow this medicine? And I didn't have one big story that could carry all those different things. It wasn't a Michael Lewis-esque book in that sense, because I didn't find one story to carry that, but I tried to do it on a sort of micro scale. Within each chapter, I had one or two stories, and that was very much a conscious process. I had all the studies and information that I wanted to write about first, and then I was like, okay, well, I can't just say, and then there's another study, researchers found this, and repeat that 100 times throughout the book. So I was, okay, I need to find a story that kind of illustrates some of these themes, and then try and have that carry some of the load that I can then say, oh, and that's this idea is demonstrated in this study. You kind of bring the studies in peripherally. So yeah, I was definitely trying to do that, but that's why I say it's harder than it looks, is that I definitely didn't succeed in the way that Michael Lewis does.
Well, we'll come back to the bit more about Endure in a short while. I've got two more questions for you, but I'm just going to skip to the last one, because we talked about the bucket list of books there, and that I'm going to have to read over the next year to add to my list of books and pile of books that are on the shelves. So talking of bucket lists then, what things have you, because you're not that old, so what things have you got left in your life that you want to accomplish or places that you want to go to?
Yeah. I mean, well, other than getting my inbox down to zero messages, which is the sort of eternal goal that I
Where are you at now with this? Because I've spoken to people recently who've got 15,000 messages in their inbox, and that's just
I'm at about 450 right now, but that's because I move messages out of my inbox once I've addressed them. But yeah, there's 450 that have been unaddressed, including some pretty important ones, because I've been traveling and I've been sick, as you might be able to hear in my voice. So yeah, 450 is not the worst in the world, but that's at the cost of my sanity, trying to constantly fight the email deluge.
I feel pretty smug then that my inbox currently stands at 31.
Yeah, oh, that's the dream. When I get down to below about 50, I feel like I'm just totally relaxed, life is going. But anyway, that is not a very exciting goal, and somewhat tongue in cheek. Really on my bucket list of the landscapes that draw me and attract me is the far north, not necessarily the North Pole. That's almost too bucket listy. Then this, you know, that doesn't draw me in the same way that going to the top of Mount Everest doesn't necessarily draw me, but exploring the wilderness in the far north of Canada is something that, I've done a very little bit of it. I did a 10 or 11 day canoe trip in the Yukon several years ago, which was where we were just totally in, you know, hundreds of miles from anybody else. And it was amazing. And I just find that growing up in Canada, I guess it's always been part of my sort of, you know, national psyche. And so the things that I dream of are getting on a trip really far north, you know, or north of the Arctic Circle, and exploring some of that really, really, wild and unsettled and untrammeled land.
Do you still race at all? And do you have any races and sort of adventures, like athletic adventures, that you'd like to sort of do?
Yeah, that's a good question. I do most of just the, you know, the last, since my kids have been born, and during that time, my wife's been a medical trainee and working pretty long hours. So my training has been regular, but relatively short. So not a lot of volume, even if I get out 6 days a week. So I've been racing mostly 5Ks and 8Ks and things like that. I am signed up for the London Marathon this spring, mainly because I'm speaking at a conference there the day before, and I had the opportunity to get into it. I thought, well, you don't turn down a spot in the London Marathon. But then, you know, after I replied yes, then I'm like, oh man, I need to ramp up my training. But beyond that, in terms of things that I'd like to do, what, again, in a sort of similar vein, what I'm interested by the ultra world, not so much because I have a sort of crushing desire to run 100 miles, but I love the idea of running through the mountains, doing ultra trail races through the mountains. UTMB, the Mont Blanc race, is sort of it's almost become too big and too, you have to really check off a lot of boxes to get there. But the idea of going from point A to point B around a really, really big mountain in the middle of nowhere, doing it in a way that's hard and challenging, but it's not like a sprint or anything like that. I love that idea, but I think to do that, you need to be, well, to do that and to enjoy it, you need to be trained properly. You need to have a reasonable training background. And right now, I'm not well enough trained for that. And so I think, like, bucket list style, like when my kids are old enough that they're easier to leave alone, I'd love for my wife and I to do some mountain ultras, some long distance races.
I've spent a bit of time in the Italian Alps and the Dolomites last year, and there was a race on in Cortina when we went through there. It was can't remember what it is now. It's quite a famous one, but when you look at the skyline around there, it's just jagged and, yeah, awesome, big, jagged and awesome. And I mean, it frightens me to think of the trails and the little arêtes that you'd be navigating. But what an awesome experience to run in that sort of arena.
Yeah, definitely. It definitely captures my imagination. But it's maybe a good metaphor for sport and for life in general, that there's a big difference between thinking, hey, that looks cool, and actually doing the work to make that dream come true. Yeah. And at this point, I have not done the work to make that dream come true, at least in a meaningful way.
All right, well, let's talk about some of the work you have done then. So I was interested in your first book when I was doing a little research on you. Which comes first, cardio or weights? Now, this is, I have a strength training background, and so it's a big thing of mine that most endurance athletes don't do enough or any strength training, and that if they did, they'd be much more robust and they'd be less likely to get injured. What did you discover in writing this book about which one of those comes first?
Yeah. Well, I should first acknowledge that I'm the poster boy for endurance athletes who should know better but don't do as much strength training as they should. The book, just to give some context, it's basically subdivided into, I think it was 111 relatively short questions and answers. So just tackling common questions like, should you stretch before you exercise, or how long does it take to get in shape, or is there a right way to run, and all these, and just sort of basically trying to look up the science and say, here's what we know and here's what we don't know about these questions. One of those questions, which is a sort of common one for among recreational exercisers and among serious exercisers, is if I'm going to go do a strength training session and an aerobic session, like a run or a swim or a bike, which should I do first?
Ah, okay.
And yeah, so the title is right up there among the worst titles in the history of humanity. Because every time anyone asks me about it, I have to explain what the title meant. And then my answer to the question is actually totally deflating. So at the time I wrote the book, and this is actually a really good sort of illustration, I think, of the way exercise science works. There was a stream of research that was just developing that was looking at the molecular signaling responses to exercise. So you can say that when you go do an aerobic based exercise, your muscle cells send out a certain set of signals that will ultimately trigger let's say, increases in mitochondria. Whereas if you do a strength training session, you'll have a slightly different set of molecular signals so that your muscles know they should, the fibers should get bigger and stronger. And there was some findings that were looking at the switch between how does your muscle know whether to be in strength training, strength building mode or endurance building mode? How do the cells know? And there's a molecular switch. And what they found is that your cells can't switch instantly from one to the other. And so this there was an argument that, you know, if your focus is getting stronger, you should probably do the strength training first, because if you do the strength training second, your muscle cells, by the time they're not going to be in the optimal strength building mode, you're not going to get as much benefit out of a given strength workout. And I thought that's pretty cool. That's really interesting. And that gives some practical guidance to answer this question of which you should do first. Now, that was 2010-ish. The science is still correct, but looking back now, I would say I was a little bit too taken by the fancy molecular science. And what I would say now in answer to that question of which one you should do first is other factors, just situational factors, probably play a bigger role rather than the subtle difference in molecular switching. And the advice actually is still pretty similar, because if you're whatever's most important to you, you should do first in on that day, because you're going to be tired afterwards. So you need to think carefully about which session you want to be freshest for. But you also, I think, especially for recreational athletes, it's like, what fits best into your life? Like if you have a gym at work and you want to run home or cycle home, don't change everything up just because you think, oh, I should run first and then do the gym. If you have a gym there, do your strength workout and then run home. Like, do what fits into your life. And that's going to be far more important than worrying about the sort of marginal changes due to molecular signaling. So all of this is to say that my answer to the question is kind of like, I now realize that we should maybe not understand what the important variables to worry about are and which ones are less important. But I will just finish by saying, despite that long and waffling answer, part of the insights from researching that book did convince me that, oh yeah, you know what? Strength training is more important than I realized, especially for someone like me, an aging endurance athlete. I'm in my 40s now, and realizing that, for most of my prime competitive career, I was probably on the lower end of the sustainable amount of muscle to meet my performance needs. And as I get older, we all just, as part of the process of aging, we start losing muscle. It's now, maybe it wasn't a limiting factor for me in my 20s. I would bet that just the amount of muscle mass I have is a performance limiting factor for me. And the more strength training I'm willing to do, the more I'll be able to hold off some of those age-related slowdowns. Much more so for me as a skinny endurance athlete than for someone who started out with a bigger reserve of muscle.
So I think coaches are fond of saying it depends. And of course, a good summary of that would be it depends, because it does depend on your age, your goals, your body type, and your previous history.
Like I said, there's 111 questions in the book, and I think probably 108 of them could be answered by it depends.
That could be the world's shortest book, couldn't it? It depends, and then just a blank page inside. Make up your own answers. Going back to the original question and my point about endurance athletes not engaging in strength training quite as enthusiastically as they should, one of the methods I'd tried to work in with some people was to, instead of if they had an hour to devote to some endurance training, spend 10 minutes doing some running drills, and then maybe spend 10 minutes doing a little weight circuit that would get the heart rate up. So fulfilling the same purpose as 20 minutes of progressively increasing your running, and then go out and run for 40 minutes. So now you've probably got the same aerobic workout. You've achieved the same thing, but you've actually managed to get your strength training in on the same day. And it sort of combining them together means they both get done. Even if you're only doing 10 minutes three times a week, that's 30 minutes more than you were doing previously. And if you do that regularly, that's probably enough for a lot of people.
Yeah. And I will say, so, in my own life, what I've realized is that if I want to run 6 days a week, and then if in the course of my busy life, I'm like, and I'm also going to go out and do a strength workout. It's not going to happen. So the most effective way I've found is very similar to that. And the other thing I've found is that, let's say I've carved out whatever it is, whether it's 30 minutes or 40 minutes or 50 minutes to get out for a run. If I say, okay, I've got to get out for a run and I also need to do some circuits. If I go out for a run, I'll enjoy the run and I'll just push it right to the very limit so that then when I get back, it's like, oh, well, no time. So even though the run is what I enjoy, I have an outdoor playground with some fitness equipment that's a 2-minute jog away from me. So I jog 2 minutes down or 2.5 minutes down the street to this park. And I do, you know, it might be some pull-ups, some body weight squats, some one-legged jumps, some dips, maybe 6 exercises with upper body and lower body that take me 5 to 10 minutes, probably 10 minutes, I guess, if I do the full circuit. And then I go out for my run with whatever time's left. And often I find that when I do it that way, then I'll be like, oh, you know what? Instead of 30 minutes, I have 40 minutes because I want to get out for a longer run. So I'll push the time a little. But I force myself to eat my vegetables before I allow the dessert. And that has nothing to do with molecular signaling and everything to do with understanding my own psychology and what it's going to take for me to get that workout in the bag.
Yeah, there's so many ways you can fit it into a day. I think my message to everybody is it's even if you don't like it, everything else is better if you do.
Including
aging, which
yeah, that's the biggest motivation for me. Is like I do want to be able to get out of a chair in another 30 years or whatever the case may be.
Yeah, well, I'm a few years ahead of you, Alex, and I'm starting to see some of my peers struggling to do some of the stuff they did when they were younger because they focused too much on swimming, biking, and running. And whilst their heart and lungs are still in good order, the rest of the body works starting to look like that of an old car. I sort of liken them to one of those old classic cars where the engine runs perfectly, but the panels are hanging off.
Yeah.
So what other myths? Let's see if you can share with us a few myths that you exploded in your book and a few truths that you were able to confirm.
Yeah, I mean, at the time, so this is, the book came out in 2011, one of the ones that caused the most consternation was looking at static stretching. Is static stretching the solution to all of life's problems, or is it the cause of all of life's problems? And, the answer, as we just discussed, was it depends. But to me, it was surprising to realize how thin the literature on static stretching was, or it maybe to put another way, how thick the literature was, but how thin the results were. So tons and tons of studies, but very little evidence that just a sort of generic static stretching program, first of all, doing it before a workout doesn't do anything to prevent you from getting sore the next day or whatever. No. And certainly the evidence that it prevents injuries is in a sport like running, not a sport like ballet or figure skating or whatever, where range of motion is a limiting factor. But in a sport like running, static flexibility, the evidence is weak. I'm not going so far as to say that there's no place for it, but that was a surprise to me. And in fact, I when I started looking at that literature, this is 15 years ago, let's say, I stopped static stretching, and I haven't had any problems with it since. It may come back to bite me if I can't touch my toes in the long run.
So if you stopped static stretching, did you replace that with anything?
I replaced it with dynamic stretching before hard workouts. But I mean, I spent a good decade or more doing a lot of static stretching. Before every workout, after every run of any description. So before any speed workout, after my warm up. But then after most runs, and then sometimes, again in the evening, like we're talking, 10 to 20 sessions a week of static stretching. And I replaced that with dynamic stretching or dynamic drills, let's call them, before speed workouts, which have a sort of dual purpose. They're kind of building strength a little bit as well as working on your dynamic flexibility. And for me, that's been fine. I'm definitely not... I'm not making any definitive statements about what's good or what's bad, but that's, I guess what I found is there's a lot of people who love stretching and who find it's essential to them feeling good in a workout. And there are other people who really hate it. And I've definitely been one of them. I was a kid who you know, at the age of, you know, 5 or 6 years old, had trouble sitting cross-legged in kindergarten because I have whatever genetic variants are that dictate lack of flexibility. So for me, it was always a real chore. And so what I would say now is the evidence doesn't say you shouldn't stretch. I mean, there's some evidence that done at the wrong time or the wrong way, it can temporarily decrease performance, but that's not really a big concern. The evidence doesn't say don't stretch, but to me, the evidence says if you really don't like stretching, static stretching, there's not a hugely compelling case, and you don't have any specific like imbalance or problem area. There's not a hugely compelling case that you have to be doing it every day to try and, you know, to reduce your chance of injury.
I have a friend who's been on this podcast, actually. She's called Sarah Pitts, and she is a mobility specialist, and her thing is to not to do static stretching, but to get into a position, but then to do small movements that keep the muscles moving. And you know, this I don't know if you've familiar with Kelly Starrett. I mean, he talks a lot about mobility, and I know for
a supple leopard.
That's right, the supple leopard. And I know for a fact that some of my injury problems were caused by lack of mobility in my upper back, which meant my, you know, my hips had to work harder, and that shunted down to my calves and Achilles. But equally, some of the problems that I was getting with my lower limbs were to do with weakness in my calves and tightness in my ankles. So I've been a beneficiary of mobility, but it's definitely not static stretching. It's more I do the dynamic mobility stuff and a lot of running drills before I run. And I spend a lot of time doing, you know, sort of slow movement, almost like a yoga flow type of thing, where you're actually moving and getting into a posture. But it's worked for me.
Yeah. And I think, you know, if you ask elite athletes what they do, an awful lot of them still spend a lot of time thinking about and working on mobility. So I want to be cautious not to throw the baby out with the bathwater, but it's definitely the sort of article of faith that if you don't do the sit and reach touching your toes before a workout, you know, you're going to snap your hamstring and you're going to end up injured. I think that's not the case, at least not as well supported as I thought when I was an athlete. And it changed my approach.
What about things that you were able to confirm as having some basis, some decent basis behind them?
I mean, one of the simplest and obvious from a health perspective is that, man, even just a single workout has, a single bout of exercise has significant health benefits. You can measure after one workout how much better your blood sugar control is, and it will enhance your cognitive performance. And then if you can stack those together, the benefits of consistency, that in a sense, doing something every day is so much more important than getting the detail, or if not every day, you know, on a regular basis, than the details of what percentage of your heart rate were you at and for what duration and, you know, all the details. So that was the number one takeaway that I was trying to leave people with is, you know, exercise really works. You should do it on a regular basis. And once you're doing it, then you can worry about the details of like, am I doing it right? But don't get caught up with the, you know, exercise is an area where you hear a lot of loud voices about the right way of doing this and the wrong way of doing that. And that's a secondary concern, I think.
We chatted about Stephen Seiler pre-recording, and he did a presentation about the hierarchy of endurance needs. I don't know if you've ever seen that. It's based on Maslow's hierarchy of human needs, but they're very interesting. You should. I'll share it with you if you've not seen it. But right at the very bottom is just train frequently. There's a lot of evidence that training frequently works. Just getting the volume in. It doesn't matter whether you're doing high intensity or low intensity. Just train frequently. Then if you're going to divide it up, just add a little bit of high intensity work every now and again. And then if you want to go a bit further, sort of split it up 90-10, 80-20. Those bottom three layers of the pyramid have a lot of evidence that they work. And then once you go above that and you started adding in periodization, micro-periodization, training at altitude, heat training, using gadgetry, you know, manipulation to dietary aspects, those things, the evidence is less certain. But for most people, if you get those bottom three right, you can get an awful long way along towards your goal without making it too complex.
Yeah, and for at a far smaller investment of time and money and energy than people are willing to spend sometimes chasing that 1% or that 0.1% at the top of the pyramid.
Yeah, well, we'll come on to that in a little while. I wanted to move on to the conversation, and we could have talked all day, I've no doubt, about those myths and truths, but we should perhaps less encourage people to get hold of your book if they want to find out all 111.
Yeah.
But yeah, endure, then, the curiously elastic limits of endurance performance. You did a great presentation, as I mentioned, at Boulder, the Endurance Coaching Summit, and you had five areas where you felt people could improve. I'll list them off and then we can chat briefly about them. So the brain is the thing that sets the limits. It's the brain that sort of stops you, almost like that. I don't know how much of this central governor theory you subscribe to, but if that's Noakes' central governor theory is true, then that's the thing that kicks in to stop you.
Yeah. Well, it's the terminology is much disputed these days, and even Noakes, I think, doesn't use central governor as much as he used to. But
okay,
the fundamental premise is that it's a self-defense mechanism that prevents you from that decides to throw on the brakes. Yeah.
Okay. The environment matters. So we'll dive in a little bit more of these in a second. Training or running with the pack or cycling or whatever, or being in that group environment, I suppose, is something you can harness. This was the one that really got me, actually. You showed a little study where 90 minutes of sitting in front of your computer was as stressful on the body as doing 100 drop squats.
From a mental perspective, not just the sort of sitting is uncomfortable, but that if your mind is tired, then you're not going to perform well in the same way as if your legs are tired.
Yeah, so you wouldn't do 100 drop squats the day before a race. So, you know, if you wanted to get your best performance, perhaps you also ought to avoid sitting in front of your computer for too long the day before a race. That was a big eye-opener for me. And also about building your belief that whole thing. And then you had another one, actually. And as I was listening to this one, I was thinking of some of the significant triathletes that I know that smile. Because smiling was the big thing. And Chrissy Wellington, Natasha Badman, Lucy Gossage, all very successful female iron distance triathletes have all been known for smiling a lot throughout their races.
Chrissy Smiles is her Twitter handle, I think.
Absolutely. Yeah. So let's talk about those in a bit more detail. So let's go back to the brain then and this whether this central governor theory holds any water or not. How can we harness the power of our brain then to make some breakthroughs?
Well, I think sort of step zero, and this is what I intend this one is just understanding and believing and realizing that when you hit the wall or when you reach the point where you can't go any farther, or in the middle of a race when you see your competitor starting to pull away from you or your goal time starting to slip away, that often feels like an absolutely non-negotiable physical barrier that, so, oh, well, I would love to do this, but in the same way that I'm only 6 feet tall and therefore I can't dunk a basketball, I'm unable, my legs are unable to run any faster than I am running right now. That's how racing feels to me, for sure, when those moments of truth. And so what the sort of research over the last 20 years has been kind of trying to get at is the idea that if you really try and isolate it, if you really try and say, what determines the point at which you say, I can't keep up anymore, or I can't go any farther, there's no physiological variable that is maxed out in those situations. It's not that your blood is so acidic that it's about to start melting your blood vessels. There's one thing that is maxed out, and that is your subjective perception of effort. Or it's not even maxed out, but it's higher than you're willing to tolerate at that point. And so, you know, there are various ways of exploring this experimentally. One of the ones I talked about in the talk you attended was a study looking at people who were seeing how long they could sit against the wall with no chair. And they offered them a certain amount of money for every 20 seconds they could stay up. And the more money they offered, the longer people could stay up. And so this demonstration that, you know, if you offer them one amount of money and they sit against the wall until their legs are trembling and collapse to the floor, they say, that's it. My legs couldn't hold me up anymore. But if you increase the money, all of a sudden, turns out that they were able to stay up a little longer. And what felt like a complete physical failure had to have been influenced by the brain, because only the brain knew when they were offered more money. And so on the one hand, this is a totally intuitive result. Of course, if you offer me $1 billion, I'm going to manage to squeeze a little bit more out of myself. But it's important to understand that that's taking place pretty much anytime you feel like you've hit your limits. It doesn't mean you can do anything you want. It doesn't mean that if I offer you $1 million, you're going to be able to go run a sub-1 hour marathon or anything like that. Our limits are within the constraints of our physical reality. But the actual moment of failure is dictated by the brain.
Yeah, I often think in those situations when we've all got to the point where we think we've had enough, if an angry dog came running out of a gateway or if somebody was chasing you with a gun, I'm pretty certain that I'd be able to run a little bit faster to save my life.
I have a training partner who that guy I've been running with for 20 years now. That is his literal strategy in races. He says he always in a race, when someone's starting to pull away from him, he'll pick a tree or a bush and say, "Now imagine if someone jumped out from behind that tree with a gun. Could I go a little faster?" And the answer is always yes. And of course, you can only play that trick on yourself so many times. But it's true. It's almost always true. In some ways, it's a conscious decision. You're halfway through the race. Of course, you're not sprinting all out because you have to go for the other half of the race. And so you're making a cognitive decision, but at least sort of understanding that and separating it out from the feeling that I can't and realizing that what you're really saying is I won't because I think I shouldn't. And then you can negotiate with that and think, well, maybe I should. Maybe actually the last few times I raced, I reached the finish line and I actually wasn't completely smashed. So maybe I can afford to be a little more aggressive than what my internal pacing template is telling me is correct.
Go to an Ironman and look at people in the middle of that 26 miles. It's just such an enormous way to go. It's overwhelming for a lot of people. But in that last mile, when they've been on the go for 15 or 16 hours, those legs that could only carry them through a walk earlier on suddenly are able to run again. How does that happen? You don't suddenly get this huge injection of food or carbohydrate or anything else. It's just knowing that running just for 1 mile is going to put an end to your pain. Whereas when you've got 13 miles to go, I guess that there's that fear that if I keep running now, I'm going to have to endure another 2 hours of this, and that's just too overwhelming. And I mean, I think people think that the elite athletes are somehow mentally stronger. I think they just have better tactics sometimes. I heard Bradley Wiggins saying, when you're on one of those big climbs in the Alps, you just break it down. Let's go for the next 2 minutes, then the next 2 minutes, and don't think any further than the next 2 minutes. But and that comes back to that whole thing about being present and being in the moment rather than thinking too far ahead.
Yeah. And there's been some interesting analyses of world records over the past century in running, and over 5K and 10K, even the best runners in the world, they have their last K is almost always the fastest. That they feel they're on the best day of their lives. It's not that they've paced poorly. They're the best day of their lives, best runners in the world. They feel like they're going as hard as they can, but in the last K they realize, oh, I can get a little bit more out of myself. But if you look at the trend over the past century, the pacing's been getting more and more even. It's not that there's still a finishing spurt, but they're getting some of the slack out. Whereas if you were to look at the way people paced a century ago, when the top runners were basically amateurs who, training in a very light way by our standards and very little experience, they were leaving a lot on the table by not being able to pace themselves quite as close to the edge as modern athletes do.
You talked about the environment. I've mentioned this in a few podcasts. Previous to the 2012 Olympics, I was talking to a British female triathlete called Jodie Swallow, and I asked her what her predictions were for the women's triathlon. And she said, well, look, it's going to be one of these five women, but these five women will make up the three medalists. And when I asked her how certain she was, she said, because I know all of these girls, and they're all in balanced relationships. They're all in a great place mentally and physically. They've all been living in an environment that that's just supports and enhances their lifestyle and their training, so that they're just happy. They're in a happy place. Is that what you meant by this environment matters?
Yeah, I mean it's so the example that I used to illustrate this is there's a study by from the University of Kent a few years ago where they put cyclists through an endurance test while flashing pictures of smiling faces or frowning faces on the wall, and it was just for a blink. It was at 16 milliseconds at a time, which is a tenth of a blink. So they didn't even realize they were seeing faces, but they were perceiving them unconsciously. And when they were shown smiling faces, they lasted 12% longer in this endurance test than when they were shown frowning faces. And to me, you know, and we can get into the mechanism of how or why that might happen. But basically, I think the upshot is seeing a smiling face puts you in a slightly better mood. And when you're on the bike asking yourself, can I keep going for another 10 seconds? If you're just in a better overall headspace, you're more likely to say, okay, yeah, I can keep going for 10 more seconds. And that ends up having a measurable impact on performance. And so to me, it's like, well, if 16 milliseconds of a smiling face can make a measurable difference, think of, you know, what an encouraging or discouraging comment from a coach can do, or from a partner, or think of your physical environment, the way it's making you feel confident, you know, the things that are around you, the messages on the wall or whatever, or making you feel depressed, like it's pointless or impossible. So, and I think these things are very individual. Not everyone responds to the same things, but I think understanding that if you're in an environment where everyone is kind of bringing you down, and it's not always easy to change your environment, but to understand that your environment can have an impact, and certainly for coaches, for people who are helping other people, to understand the impact that they can have in subtle ways beyond just writing the correct workout, but by helping build people's self efficacy, their confidence, their positive feelings about what's coming up.
Makes you think about all of those army PTIs that scream and shout at people and tell them how useless they are. Get over that fence, you're useless, come on. And if they just sort of took a more lenient approach and smiled a bit, wonder whether that would motivate those soldiers a bit more.
There's some great studies in from other sports. There's some research from rugby by a guy named Christian Cook, and I hope I'll get the details right here, but he did a study with professional rugby players in London, I think it was. And he had got great cooperation from the team. They played a professional match, like as part of the regular season. After the game, half the players got a positive individual video breakdown session where the coach went over their video of their performance in the game and pointed out all the things they did right and said, that was great. I want to see more of that next week. And the other half got negative feedback. The video focused on the things they'd done wrong. And the coach said, this is where you screwed up. Stop making these mistakes. Stop doing this. And they could measure right after they measured cortisol levels and stress hormones and testosterone levels, things like that. And the players who got the negative feedback had lower testosterone levels right after. But what was fascinating is a week later, before their next match, the players who got the negative feedback still had lower testosterone levels as they started to anticipate the challenge of the next game. And independent raters of game performance who rated each player's performance, the players who had received the negative feedback the week before had worse performance on average than those who got the positive feedback. Now, the important caveat is that that was on average. There was huge individual variation. And so it seemed like there were some players who did respond well to being berated and having their mistakes pointed out. And whenever I talk about this stuff, there's always, you know, there's often people who will say, well, you know, I feel like I need to be really angry to compete at my best. And it's like, you may be right. That may be your personal psychology. So it's not that there's necessarily a one size fits all, but back to the sort of tagline, your environment matters and your headspace matters. And it may not be that everyone needs the same environment, but one way or another, you're responding to that environment.
Yeah. And you often see that even in some of the greatest performers. I mean, look at Tiger Woods. He went through that purple patch, but then all of a sudden his life started to unravel, starting with his injuries, you know, not being able to practice, not being able to take part in tournaments and his extracurricular stuff. you know, there's been other, I can't think of any to mind right now, but there's been other meltdowns in great performers who've just had things going bad in their personal lives that have then started to affect their whole life, and it just all unravels.
Yeah, for sure.
So you talked about harnessing the pack, and I guess that this relates back to our brain setting the limits, that if you're in a pack, somehow you can push through that pain barrier a little bit more. If you're running with a group, and you know, sometimes the cyclists say it's if you're on the back of a pack and it's going fast, it's you're dying. But if you get dropped off the back of the pack, you're basically dead, and it's better to be dying than dead.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So an example here of that sort of illustrates this is there was a study actually with the Oxford University rowing team where they did pain tolerance tests, and it's pretty well known that exercise or working out enhances your pain tolerance, because you produce a bunch of brain chemicals that will, like adrenaline, that help you ignore pain. So they brought these rowers in to the lab one by one, put them on a rowing machine, and before and after they tested their pain tolerance with a blood pressure cuff. And sure enough, doing a standard workout enhanced their pain tolerance. But when they repeated the study, they brought them in, instead of bringing them in one by one, they brought them into the lab all together and put them on rowing machines side by side by side by side by side, did exactly the same protocol. And this time their pain tolerance increased about twice as much after the workout. So there was something about being, you know, they weren't in the same boat or anything, but being in the room with their teammates and, you know, these people with whom they were training towards a common goal. Or maybe they were competing with their teammates, hoping that they would get the last spot on the boat. But for whatever reason, the presence of people around them doing the same thing resulted in, you know, it changed the way their brains handled trying to ignore discomfort and push through pain. So, and you know, there's other studies from some of the same researchers looking at even synchronized exercise. They found that with rugby players, when they did a running test, they did their best performance when they warmed up together and in sync, a little bit better than when they warmed up together, not in sync, and a little bit better than warming up alone. That there was, you know, and these researchers, they're actually not sports scientists, they're evolutionary anthropologists. So what they were trying to figure out is, like, why do humans cooperate? Why do they like getting together and dancing? Why does religion exist? You know, all these sorts of deep questions that end up telling us something about sport and about the fact that, yeah, there's power in being in a pack, and especially in you know, sports like biking and running, where you can be in a pack and feel like you're part of one larger organism, that the pack actually has a kind of life of its own. So
I went to shadow a racehorse trainer once. I'm really interested in the apparent polarization of training, which we talked about a little, that the horses either walk or can trot, but they very rarely do any of that middle stuff, or they go absolutely flat out. And this guy, he had his horses walking for 1 or 2 hours. He's the top flat racehorse trainer in the UK for the last few seasons. And they run slightly uphill, so strength work, slightly uphill, but not so much as to disturb running technique or gait of the horses. 800 meters, which is the speed they go, takes about 30 seconds, probably a minute to cover. They do two of those. There's a long walk back to the start in between each one, so really long recovery. And they do that twice every day, but that's the only high intensity work they do amongst all the other stuff. But what you're saying is the horses run as a group, because as a pack animal, they always want to keep up. They don't want to get left behind. So it's almost like that half wheeling thing that cyclists have, you know, this horse wants to get his nose in front of that horse. So they'll try their absolute hardest to win that particular race and to keep up with the other one. And then when it's all over, and here's something we can probably learn from animals, is they're not bothering comparing their gadgets or anything. They're just happy to walk back and nibble a bit of grass and then have the next one. And they're not too worried if that guy's got different shoes on or that one's got a fancy saddle. They just love running together and running as hard as they can.
Yeah. That sounds like Kenyan training camps.
Yeah, exactly. So let's go back to that rest the brain, because this is the one that I really like. So a typical example here that came to mind when you were talking about this was the number of athletes that are going off for a weekend to do a race. And so they may be finishing work a day early. They're going to leave on the Friday to travel there and organize themselves for the Saturday. So leaving the day early, they've got stuff to do. So they spend a lot longer on the computer the day before thinking, well, I'm sat down, so I'm not using any energy. I'm saving my legs for the run. But the evidence you presented there suggests that sitting in front of the computer for a reasonable length of time can be just as debilitating as doing some quite high intensity physical activity. And perhaps we ought to be leaving the mind quite clear on that day.
Yeah. So I should clarify this mental fatigue research, which I think is really fascinating, maybe one of the most interesting developments in research in sports research in the last decade. It's not necessarily, not just a question of sitting in front of a computer. It's focusing. So the protocol that they use is you're sitting in front of a computer and there are shapes and numbers flashing on the screen and you have to hit a button in response to whichever shape or number or arrow or whatever it is. And so you're focusing on it. It's sustained attention. So, you know, is it the same if you're sitting in front of the computer and just sort of reading emails or surfing the web? Probably not. It's different. That's still, not that that still doesn't, you know, drain your humanity, but
you've got 15,000 in your inbox.
Yeah, exactly. So it's, you know, sustained focus and mental work that create mental fatigue, and that seems to have an impact on physical performance. I mean, even they do studies on football and find that it affects decision time, reaction time, decision accuracy, and things like that. So a lot of, professional sports clubs around the world are looking at ways of dealing with this, looking at ways of training the brain to resist mental fatigue, which there's been some interesting pilot work on. But more importantly and more simply, is just understanding the role so that you can avoid mental fatigue in key points. And to your, exactly to your point, I often sort of say, you know, one of the challenges of preparing for, a marathon or something like that is you taper the week before, so you've got more time and you're like, oh, now I can do my taxes. It's like, no, doing your taxes the day before the race is probably not the way you want to use that extra time. Now, this mental fatigue research is quite new. Nobody knows exactly how much mental fatigue you get from different activities, how long it takes to recover from it, whether you just need a few hours to refresh your brain or whether, you know, a good hard session of mental fatigue is going to stick with you for 2 or 3 days. No, nobody knows that stuff. So I don't think we have any sort of really specific protocols, but I would definitely say the day before a big race, find things that are, if you try it to the extent possible within the demands of your life, find some ways of relaxing and just chilling. And then people are like, well, what if I watch a suspenseful movie? What if I, you know, is that relaxing or is that mentally fatiguing? And my answer is I have no idea. But I think the best guide we have is, how do you feel at the end of it? Do you feel drained because you've been sitting on the edge of your seat and you've actually worn a hole in the armrest from your tension? That's probably not ideal. But if you're relaxed and diverted and just kind of feel like, hey, that was nice, then that's probably good. Same with video games. And actually, I get this question from professional coaches a lot because they're like, yeah, man, my athletes, you know, they're playing whatever. I won't even pretend I know the names of the games these days, Fortnite or something, for, you know, 14 hours a day when they're not training. Is that bad? Is that good? I was like, I don't know. But I guess what you have to talk to them about is this something that leaves them feeling a little bit drained? And if so, maybe they need to think carefully about it in the context, in the sort of peri-game period, you know, right before the game or maybe even right after the game for recovery. So it's not that you never do this stuff, but just be conscious of what might be leaving you mentally. I mean, socializing, that's a classic example, right? Of like some people, they go out to the pub with friends and or go to a party or whatever. And it's like, man, they never feel more alive. They feel great. Other people, they may enjoy the socializing, but it drains them. I think people sort of understand that that's a sort of familiar concept. I think probably the same is true for lots of activities. So you just need to be sort of conscious of what are the things that leave you feeling mentally drained, and what are the things that leave you feeling energized, and stick with the latter when you're getting to the day before a big race.
Reminds me of a time when I went with a friend to they were doing an Ironman. I wasn't, but I'd volunteered on the Saturday to help down in transition with all the athletes wrecking the bike. So I said, look, I've got some videos or some DVDs here. So, you know, you're going to stay here and watch these. Don't go out, you know, keep your energy, you know, keep your powder dry for race day. I hadn't watched this film, so I hadn't realized it was going to leave them in the state it did. I just thought, well, it's a nice long film, The Green Mile.
Oh,
man, they were traumatized emotionally when I got back. I should have done my research first, I think.
Yeah, stick to Disney.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the final things that you mentioned before we move on, because I'm conscious of the time ticking away and there's a few more things I'd like to cover before we finish. You talked about building your belief. I think we've covered some of that already in some of the other factors that you mentioned. Definitely, you know, the environment matters, and that thing about the coaches and the encouragement and, you know, building belief. And also, I guess, prior experience builds the belief, doesn't it? When the brain sets the limits, if you think you can't stay with the group, but then you practice it once and you know that you can, then that builds your belief that you can do it again. So perhaps that's an endorsement for having B and C races where you test this out and see if you can, how, you know, whether you're going to blow up or how hard you can, and how long you can push through a barrier that you weren't certain about before.
Yeah, I think, I mean, for sure, the sort of, after going through all this evidence that the brain matters, the classic question is, how do you change it? And I think the most effective way is to enhance your belief that you're capable of doing something. And the most effective way of building your belief is to, if you want to run 66 seconds a lap, then, you know, if you've done 67 seconds a lap, then it's not a big leap. Whereas if you've done 75 seconds a lap, it is. Or even, I often think about this in terms of, you know, the great success of Kenyan runners or East African runners more generally. You know, they train in these massive groups. And if one guy goes out and runs a 204 marathon and you've been training with that guy for the last year and doing all the same workouts, all of a sudden you've got the belief that you can do that too. And so it becomes much more real. And so it creates this sort of cycle of great performances, because you have a justified reason for believing. Like, there's a philosophical thing about the difference between, philosophers argue about the difference between true belief, you know, justified true belief. How do you, like, if you believe something but you have no reason for believing it, is that a true belief? And I think that's true. It's like, I've certainly met and trained with some very delusional people who are convinced they're going to go out and you know, do some amazing performance. It's like, there's just no way. And that belief, having that belief doesn't help them because it's not connected to their physical capacities. So anyway, I mean, I think belief is important. I think Eliud Kipchoge is a great example of someone who about the fact that he thinks his self-belief is a big part of his ability to perform at a level that that others have not ever been able to do. And I think one thing that I've really been struck by over the last few years is that there's a lot of research now showing that techniques like motivational self-talk can enhance performance. And that is changing, you know, becoming aware of the internal monologue in your head, of the idea that if you're telling yourself, oh, this sucks, this is where I always blow up, I'm going to fail again. That's the equivalent of having a negative or a frowning face flashing on the screen in front of you. So if you can change that so that, you know, the voice in your head is telling you, yeah, you can do this. Sure, it hurts. Sure, it's tough, but this is how it's supposed to be. I've trained for this. I'm ready for it. That's going to have a positive effect on performance.
I recall a story that you told. I'm not sure in what context it was meant. You maybe it was you running, or maybe it was one of your friends, about trying to break the 4-minute kilometer of 1500 meters and having somebody stood by the track giving you times, but they were giving you the wrong times, and so you ended up running significantly faster than you'd done before. Obviously you were capable of that, but there'd been some sort of mental barrier to you getting past the 4 minute
It was a 4 minute 1500 meters, and I'd spent 4 years trying to break it. I'd been running 401 or 402 for 4 years, and basically what happened is the timekeeper was missed the start, so he was calling out splits that were about 3 seconds off. So I was going through, and each time I came through the finish area, he'd call out a time, and I'd think, "Wow, that's fast! That's way faster than I wanted to go." But I'd also realize, "But I actually feel pretty good. This is going to be the greatest day of my life. And so, you know, partway through the race, I was just like, forget about the splits. Something great is happening. And I just go for it. And I went for it and I ended up running 3:52. So it was this huge transformative breakthrough in my running career, which then, you know, from there, and I never went back after that. It got me to that next level. And I think it's really, that's one of the moments that set me on the course to want to explore this idea of limits and why it is that what feels like a brick wall can sometimes turn out to be, it turns out it was just an illusion. It wasn't a real limit.
Yeah, and we have seen examples of this previously in sport, haven't we? Once Bannister went through the 4-minute mile, several other people were able to break that in you know, a short space of time. And I think also with the Russian heavyweight weightlifter, it might have been Alexeyev, was the first man to clean and jerk 500 pounds in competition. Never been done before, but within a few months of that, it was done by several other people. And it had been done in training, but never in competition. And once they'd seen somebody else do it and realized that they weren't that much faster or better than them, it gave them the belief that they could do it as well.
Yeah, I think that does show up. And it's, you know, to emphasize, it's not like all of a sudden everyone discovers, oh, it was just a mental barrier. Now that someone else does it, we can all do it and it's easy. Usually it requires that other people are ready, but you rarely in sport see someone who's so far ahead, they break a barrier that they're not soon followed by others. And sometimes it's a real flood that follows after one person breaks it.
Just wrapping up on those five factors then that we've discussed, do you think these have the same impact for all athletes, regardless of whether they're recreational or elite?
It's an interesting question. And it's one that I, to be totally honest, it's one that I can argue both ways and convince myself that why these are way more important for recreational athletes than pros, or way less important. And so I don't think there's going back to my earlier standby answer, it depends is probably a good one. What I think is, I think these factors are definitely applicable to everyone. I think if you're talking about elite athletes, the benefits they're going to get are probably smaller. It's tiny. But if you're talking about elite athletes, they've more or less optimized everything else already. They're doing everything close to right as possible. So if they can find a way of squeaking out that extra fraction of a percent, that's really significant to them. Now, when you're talking about a typical recreational athlete, I think there's much more chance that they haven't got their mental game dialed in the same way, and that there's some big gains potentially there for the taking if they can get their mindset right. That said, that's for recreational athletes, it's often also true that there's big gains there for the taking if they can do a lot of other very basic things, taking care of their lifestyle, their health, or just training a little bit more. So I would say for elite athletes, it's like, this is one of the few areas that they haven't already maxed out, and that's why it's significant. For recreational athletes, there's bigger things on the table, but it's not the only way of getting those gains. And so I think it's useful and it's important, but there's a lot of other things to consider before thinking that, thinking happy thoughts is going to be super significant. It's like, yeah, doubling your training mileage, that's also going to make a big difference.
Yeah. Jumping forward then, I had another question that one of the ones I wanted to finish on was, looking ahead to the big breakthroughs that are going to come in sporting performance, we briefly touched on the sub-2-hour marathon. I'm sure there are others that we could think about in other sports. Those big endurance breakthroughs, are they going to come about, do you think, through improvements in fitness, through technology? And we could maybe have a little word on here about the Nike Vaporfly and all of these sort of variants of these super shoes. Is it going to come about because athletes are training the same, but they're going to be able to recover better? Or is it going to be something along the lines of what we were just discussing, where it's harnessing the power of the mind? Or is it going to be a little bit of everything?
Yeah, so if the question is big breakthroughs, which is the word you used, or breakthroughs is the word you used.
Yeah.
And I think a good example is the moment that running is living through right now. Marathon times have absolutely just completely changed in the last 2 years. I think I don't know the current stats, but even a year ago, it was the case that the five fastest men's marathons in history had all been run in the previous 12 months. And I know that in the last 2 years, the road records for 10K, for half marathon, and for marathon, for both men and women, the world records have been shattered. So there has been a huge breakthrough in running performance in the last 2 years. And it's pretty easy to identify the culprit. It's Vaporfly or similar running shoes that have a carbon fiber plate and a thick sort of next generation foam heel. So in that case, the breakthrough was technological. And I think if we're looking into our crystal ball and saying where's the next breakthrough going to come from, it's likely to be some sort of technological or external aid like that. Because I think in other respects, whatever changes happen are going to be incremental. They're going to be small and gradual. So it's technology that can give us these step changes sometimes, for better or worse. And many would argue that it's for worse at this point. So where's the progress going to come from? The slow and steady progress? I think it's going to be tough to train a whole lot harder than people are willing to train. It's not just, unlike the transition from, let's say, the 1940s to the 1960s, it's not just a question of people being willing to hurt more. As if hurting more would help, if training harder would help, people have been trying that for a while. So maybe there are some fitness gains to be had, as you said, from figuring out recovery a little bit better, from enabling people to tolerate a higher training load. But I think we're getting closer to marginal returns from that. I'll finish with the mental thing, but the one other thing that I would say, that the area that I see has potential but isn't quite there, is individualization of training stress and training load, so that you want people to be able to train as hard as possible without going over that line that starts putting them into a hole. And there's the potential with data, with personal monitoring, with all the sorts of whatever it is, collecting power and heart rate and physiological measures, nonstop data collecting. Maybe you can extract enough value from that data to be able to say, now this guy can train a little harder. No, today he needs to back off or just continue as normal. That's been the sort of goal of fitness or training tech, training monitoring for a long time now. I don't think we're there yet. I don't think it's better, but I see potential there for a breakthrough. But so that's or for at least for progress. And last and I don't know if it's least is the mental side. I guess what I think for that is that in a lot of ways, the greatest athletes have always been ones who intuitively, and the greatest coaches, have intuitively worked on this area. So it's not like nobody has thought about harnessing the mind. And someone like Eliud Kipchoge is a great example, who didn't need to see a sports psychologist to understand the importance of working on endurance. So I think there's a lot of potential for bringing up the general level of performance as the rest of us understand how important this is and how it can have an effect. But is it going to allow someone to go from a 159 or a 2 minute, 2 hour marathon to a 159 marathon? It's harder for me to see, because the 2 hour marathon guy, he already has to be amazing on the level of the mind. So I guess to actually answer your question, I guess I would say my guess, if I had to pick one, aside from the external technology like new shoes, I would say maybe the individual monitoring of training load might be the area that allows us to squeeze a little bit more juice from the orange.
Yeah, when I'm listening to you say that, my mind immediately goes to the work that Tim Kerrison does with Team Ineos, and that minute data collection, sort of individual prescription on a, as you mentioned there, on a daily basis for the riders, individual prescription of food for each rider, sleeping arrangements and sleeping time and sleeping performance and all of those things is dialed in for each person on the team, even though they're all riding the same route tomorrow and they're doing the same race over 3 weeks. Everything's very much an individual prescription based on all the data that they're constantly collecting. So it seems, anyway, from what I've read.
Yeah, that's interesting. And it may be that that science is enough of in its infancy that 99 times out of 100, they're not getting any benefit relative to if they were just told to do the same thing. But one time out of 100, it's saving someone from going over the edge. One time out of 100, it's making a difference that saves someone's season or saves someone's microcycle or whatever.
I saw on the list of articles that you'd written, you read one that called When Doping Isn't Cheating. And I'm pretty certain that we could record a whole podcast on this. So we should probably keep it quite short. But it reminds me also of a presentation I went to in Leeds just before the 2012 Olympics, where they were talking about technology and whether access to technology wasn't the same as doping and cheating, because, wealthy countries have access to greater depths of technology to, I think one of the examples they used was the British cycling track team had access to McLaren Formula One for the wind testing, for composite materials to make bikes and all that sort of stuff. And if you were a track cyclist from a poorer African country, you might be just lucky to get a bike to ride on. And so you might have all the physical capabilities, but you were just disadvantaged because you didn't have millions of pounds to throw at technology, and so that wasn't exactly a level playing field, in the same way that some athletes clearly are able to get their hands on Nike Vaporflies and other ones aren't. So I guess that's the current debate, is whether it's fair and whether it isn't, and whether those advantages should be allowed.
Yeah, it's tricky. I wrote an article, gosh, must be 8 or 9 years ago, and I think it was lead up to the, or maybe even longer, it was lead up to the Vancouver Olympics, maybe, which were hosted in 2010 in Canada, about this issue, because Canada spent a lot of money, just like Britain did in the lead up to its Olympics, on trying to ensure that we got some medals. And a lot of the focus was developing, top secret technology. And it's a really difficult issue to me. I mean, I guess I would say where I came down is, in my perfect world, sports would be sort of like them. There are some sports or activities which have generic equipment. So if you're an Olympic sailor, you show up and they give you one of the many identical lasers or whatever class of boat you're sailing. And so everyone's sailing the same boat. And if you're a modern pentathlete, you show up and you don't bring the best horse in the world. You just get assigned a horse by the luck of the draw. Mm. And to me, it's like, well, that's great, because that means you know that what you're seeing is the characteristics of the athlete. That's a hard thing to dictate. When you're talking about something like cross-country skiing or something, you can say, well, we could eliminate all the unfairness of high-tech waxes, getting the wax right and the best skis and stuff if we just assign people skis. But it's like, well, or even running shoes. Give everyone the same pair of running shoes. Well, people are different. Not everyone runs the same. You can't assign everyone to have the same set of shoes, regardless of their biomechanics and their running stride. So it's kind of a situation where I know what the ideal is in my mind, but getting there in practice is quite difficult, or impossible. That we're never going to achieve the perfect level of playing field. So it's a question of how much unevenness are we willing to tolerate, and that's a question that's been tested severely with the Nike Vaporflies, because the playing field has gotten very uneven, and other shoe companies are trying to even it out again, but it's not clear whether they're going to succeed. Ultimately, to tie that into the article that you mentioned about when doping isn't cheating, really what that article was about was looking at how arbitrary the line between doping and non-doping is. That you can take a pill full of caffeine, it'll enhance your performance. That's no problem. You can sleep in an altitude tent, to a very expensive altitude tent, to enhance your red blood cell count, but you can't take EPO.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's, and you can't take certain, you know, cold medications. You can't take decongestants, but you can take, baking soda or beta alanine to, you know, in pill form to enhance your performance. And my point or my ultimate argument was it's a sort of fool's game to try and imagine that there's some, ultimate clear black and white line where we understand that all these things to the left of the line are bad and all these things to the right of the line are good. And that's the way God intended sports to be. This line is an arbitrary list based on the best of our ability to sort of figure out what's fair, what's accessible, what's healthy. And the important thing isn't which things are allowed and which aren't. The important thing is that we all agree on where the line is. We say, okay, this one's allowed, this one isn't. It may be that there's no obvious reason that this one should be allowed while this one isn't, but that's not the point. The point is, if you show up at the Olympics, you can take this one, but you can't take that one. And it's true for everyone. So we're all going to be following the same rules. And that's the case for doping. And I think it's also the case we want to make for technology, that it's not so much a question of is this technology right or wrong? Is it relatively equally accessible so that everyone can have an equal shot at it?
Mm. Yeah. I imagine, Alex, if we had an endless supply of red wine now or caffeine, we could probably chat about this all night.
Yeah. It's not a question with any easy answers, and it's a question where reasonable people may disagree, and from what I can tell on the internet, unreasonable people are also happy to disagree very loudly.
It's the reasonable people I'm happy to chat with. It's the unreasonable people that are dogmatic and can't even see that other side of the story that I find more difficult
frustrating
to deal with. But and I've gracious for the amount of time you spent chatting with us today, Alex. And I've before we go, I've got one more question for you, if you don't mind.
Sure.
With all of the research that you've done over the past few years, with the books you've written, the articles, you know, the presentations you've given, and all the information you've shared tonight, I wondered if it would be possible for us to try to put together, for recreational athletes listening, a top five actions that they can take on a daily basis that you've from your research have seen will have the biggest impact in their performance. Either as an athlete or maybe as a human being, because sometimes I think if you're not performing well as a human being in terms of your health, then you're never going to get the best out of yourself as an athlete anyway. So what do you think? Top five?
Well, if you'd asked me this question 10 years ago when I was younger and more naive and more enthusiastic, I would have given you a different answer. It probably would have been more, you know, do this kind of training, try this training aid or recovery aid and this magic workout. I've become a little more jaded as time has gone on and realized that the sort of whatever the hot topic in the sports science world, it tends to have a half-life of 3 to 5 years and then kind of fade away. And there are some fundamentals that just remain effective and are probably more effective than anything else. So if I had to do a top five, I'd probably, in a rough order, I won't necessarily say that the order is sacrosanct, but I would say, first of all, man, sleep. If you're not getting good regular sleep, you're leaving some very, very simple or very, very substantial performance gains on the table. Second of all, eat well. Lots of debate on what that means, but let's just say lots of whole, real foods and lots of fruit and vegetables, I would say personally. Third, I would put managing stress third. In the sense that you can sleep well and you can eat well, but if those are just two check boxes on your list of 87 things that you need to get done every day, and every minute is finely scheduled, and you're always maybe two tasks behind where you want to be, or 10 tasks behind when you want to be, so you're constantly feeling like you're behind in life, which is definitely the case for me sometimes, but. I think that's hard to perform at your best. And so just sort of trying to assess what you're trying to achieve in life and what the important goals are and whether you're living your life in harmony with those goals so that you're not constantly feeling like you're behind or not doing what you're supposed to be doing, I think that makes a difference. And of course, you know, stress, we all have sources of stress that are not necessarily negotiable. If you're caring for a sick parent or whatever, you can't just be like, you know what, this is too stressful. It's going to hurt my 5K time this weekend. So, you know, good luck, mom. So it's not a question of getting rid of all stresses, but trying to find ways of managing and balancing them so they don't overwhelm you, because all stress is stress. You know, training stress is what we're applying to ourselves to try and get fitter. But if it's added on top of a mountain of other stress, then your chances of adapting properly to it are very low. So that's three. The fourth thing I would say is train. And I say that very generically, like do something every day or at least 6 days a week or whatever, you know, at whatever level you're willing to commit to. But on the days you're planning to train, unless you're sick or whatever, unless there's some reason, you know, do the get out there and do some training. That's be consistent is, I guess, the message I'm trying to give. I feel like those four things are the most important. I sort of struggle to find a fifth that belongs on the same pedestal as those four. You know, like read my book is number five, maybe, or you know, enjoy yourself, or you know, there's a bunch you could put there, or you know, even more specific ones. But I think sleep, eat well, manage stress, and train. That's if you're doing that, that's a pretty good base of the pyramid.
What I like about that is how you prefaced it all with the fact that the current trends come and go, but these things are always constant. And that in some ways they're a little boring. We can't jazz them up. We can't make them exciting. Sleep is just sleep. I know a lot of people see it as dead time, and if they could live a full life and get less sleep, they'd be happier. But the number of times that I listen to coaches and, you know, the people who know, coming back to sleep being the bedrock of all, you know, life performance. Eat well, just eat real food, not too much, mostly plants was a good bit of advice that I heard. You know, you can't go too wrong with that. I'm fairly agnostic on the philosophy that people choose to eat by, and that in itself causes those you know, unseemly internet debates. So just eat well. And I love that whole thing you said about stress. I can remember right back to a strength and conditioning conference probably 20 odd years ago with a guy called Mike Stone. You might have come across him. He's a US Olympic weightlifting coach. But he said all stressors are cumulative, and you know, it's either fight or flight, or it's rest and digest. And if it's creating stress and the release of cortisol, then it's on the fight or flight. And you do have to manage that and find time to balance it with rest and digest, which is the sleeping and the eating well, and you know, the relaxing. So, yeah, love it. Thanks. Great advice. Great to hear it confirmed again. And thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciated all the knowledge and insights that you've shared.
Well, thanks, Simon. It's been fun. We've covered many different corners of the world. So yeah, it's been a fun conversation.
Where can our listeners find you if they'd like to follow some of the work you're doing, or maybe even purchase your books? I guess they're available on Amazon, are they?
Yeah, they're available pretty much anywhere. The easiest place to find me is on Twitter. My handle is Sweat Science, all one word. Anytime I have an article either of my own or of something else I find interesting, I post it there. I'm also on Facebook at Sweat Science. And I do have a website, alexhutchinson.net, where you can, it's, you know, pretty seriously outdated, but you can find more basic information on me and stuff I've written in the past. But yeah, Twitter's probably the place to go.
Okay. I will get hold of the correct titles of those books and some links to them on Amazon. I'll reference, or maybe I'll get you to send me the references to some of those bits of research. You mentioned the Blanchfield 2014 study on the smiling faces was interesting. And I'll put those all in the show notes. So everybody will be able to follow you. Expect an upsurge in Twitter Twitter followers in a few
from
weeks.
From the reasonable people of the world.
From the reasonable people of the world, yeah. If you're interested in good, sensible debate, then Alex is the person. If you want an argument, then don't go near him. Great. Okay, Alex, thanks so much. Enjoy the rest of your day over there in Canada, and we'll catch up again soon, no doubt.
Okay, thanks, Evan.
Right then, that's a wrap for this week. Thanks again for listening. As always, I appreciate that you have plenty of choice out there in podcast land, so it does mean an awful lot to me when you come back regularly. If you enjoyed the podcast, please could you hop onto iTunes or Podbean and leave a rating and a comment if you can. Apparently, it's really good for the ratings, although to be absolutely honest with you, I have no idea how they work these things out. If you like the way I roll and you find some synergy with my approach to life and sport, maybe be interested in joining my SWAT Inner Circle training group. If you are, please just email beth@thetriathloncoach.com for more details. You can also use that email address to ask for my special free gift, which I have for you, which are my top 25 tips on how to be a high-performance human. Okay, that's all for this week. I'll be back next week with another great guest. So for now, enjoy the rest of your week.